Group meeting, Sunday, 7th August, 1983. The whole world is a school of life for all sentient creatures. All sentient creatures. It is a school in which what this thing we call consciousness is undergoing an evolution. And all our experience and study and observation is directed, or should be directed, towards bringing about that consummation. As you all know, we are conscious in our own day and age in terms of the finite and the temporal. We are conscious in terms of beginning and ending, of birth and death. And we are conscious of our own organism very intimately, not so much intimately as very vividly. The I consciousness is extremely strong, and that is the self for us. And we are conscious of the world as a whole as the not-self, something different from us, definitely. But unfortunately, the human race is inclined to regard the world, the not-self, as something opposed to each of us. Because we are conscious in this manner, therefore there is perpetual conflict. This kind of consciousness makes us draw boundary lines everywhere. This is good, this is bad. This is pleasant, this is unpleasant. This is helpful to me, this is not helpful to me, and so on. But in practically every case, these boundary lines are drawn by consciousness which is self-centered. We are not developed to the extent of true egohood. Our egohood is bedeviled through and through with egoism. And with that egoism goes, of course, vanity and all those qualities which we call vices and so forth. So our life and our activities in this school of life is one in which we are, as a human race, we have hardly begun to learn how to cooperate with life as a whole in that manner which will promote the evolution of consciousness. For mankind, this is specifically for mankind, the evolution of consciousness culminates in a release from the limitations imposed upon us by our way of regarding everything in terms of the finite and the temporal, of beginning and ending, birth and death, of pleasure and pain, and all the duals, and very often more than the duals. So we are not learning how to live in that manner. This is where religion and any really deep and constructive psychology comes in. Psychotherapy can come in here. But religion has gone most deeply into all this and shows us the different stages which are experienced by the growing consciousness, starting right from infancy to the perfected holy state. Now, this school of life, the world as such, is of course immeasurably richer and greater than anything that we know of it, or can conceive of it, or imagine about it. It's immensely greater. And the forces at play work all the time, whether we know some of them or not. So it's a little bit like this. If a person is walking by a cliff edge and he's absent-minded, he might make a sudden journey of 2,000 feet or so down below, and his condition won't be a happy or a healthy one when he has reached the bottom. So, you see, why? Because the force of gravity doesn't take into account that this poor chap was absent-minded, and therefore I mustn't act upon him in such a way that when the idiot steps over the edge, he will not be dashed to pieces. Of course he will be. And that's that. So you see, the universal process has an extremely harsh and what we would call a harsh and a cruel side to it. But we must take into account the fact that we were not attentive. You know how in the systems of law throughout the world, ignorance of the law is no excuse. If you do wrong, you've had it. If you get caught, that is. You see? But this school of life affects us in various ways. It pricks us hard. But it doesn't prick us so hard that we as psychophysical beings will perish straight away. It allows a great deal of latitude. The organism has plenty of elasticity. It has remarkable powers for recovering from hurt, from illness, from the mistakes we make in all sorts of ways, morally, intellectually, and so on. But this prick is something which sooner or later decides us to enter, consciously to enter, deliberately to enter the school of life and work as students in this school of life. So the prick of dukkha is one of the great forces which decides, which makes us decide to go to school in the right way, the real way. Because we start asking questions, what is this? Why is this? What is the purpose of my existence? How have I come into being? What happens to me after I'm dead, and so forth? The assumption being that I will be after I'm dead. Of course, it's a totally stupid assumption. It's totally stupid for the very simple reason that the person identifies himself with some aspect of himself, the psychophysical organism or other, you see, some aspect or other. Now, all these aspects of our psychophysical organism, every single one of them is something which is perishable. It doesn't last forever. That is all. And the different aspects of which we are aware, all are interdependent upon each other. If one goes out completely, the whole lot will go out. You see? Supposing, for instance, the feeling element in us went out. And if he couldn't touch, and if he couldn't feel emotionally and intellectually too, then we'd be so insensitive that the ordinary process of everyday life would kill us off. You see, we couldn't survive it. We couldn't withdraw from the painful sensation when it comes. And the pain, and if painful sensations are sufficiently painful and sufficient in quantity, one, the organism will perish. You see? So, the prick of suffering wakes us up and we start inquiring what's it all about and so forth. Now that is the entrance into the school of life, the kindergarten stage. So we go rushing about, reading books, studying philosophies, rushing along to psychotherapists, to the priests, to doctors, to clever people, to Firoz Behta and all that crowd, you see, and so forth, which is all nonsensical, to tell you the truth. There comes the point when one begins to see for oneself, to look and listen carefully. Mind you, it is necessary in the very early stages to have help. The infant, for example, it must have help all along the line, otherwise it would perish. If there wasn't mama and mama's breast a few days after birth, there would be a funeral. So it's like that. So we must have some sort of help all along the line. And the books and the studies and the people and so forth and the schools and whatnot of psychology, philosophy and religious doctrines and all that, they all play their part. Therefore, nothing is to be despised. Everything has its place. And if we learn that lesson, not to despise anything whatsoever, the very roots of compassion within us, dormant within us, begin to get stronger and stronger. This is of special importance because it is impossible to grow in wisdom without compassion. And as we grow in wisdom, that wisdom aids compassion and makes compassion grow and grow. To use the Buddha's own phraseology, the original phraseology in Pali, you make become compassion, wisdom, etc. You make it to become, meaning thereby that all this is latent within us. It is dormant within us. And it requires all this external stimulus to make us take a hand positively and therefore self-responsibly in bringing all these things to fruition, thereby fulfilling one of the great purposes of our existence in the world. But of course, help has to be given to the person so that the person begins to know at least one of the great purposes of our existence in the world, and how that can be fostered, the knowledge of it can be fostered, and the way to bring it about can be made open for that person. Now, there comes the point in the person's development when he sees that the fundamental basis of all true growth, the meaning thereby growing, to realize fruition as a perfect human being. This is important. to realize fruition as a human being. He begins to see that the essential foundation, of course, is in pure living. What the Buddha casually almost called right conduct. Behave yourself. Right conduct of mind, speech, and action, deed. When that basis becomes stronger and stronger, the right foundation has been laid, and one's power, one's insight begins to develop very, very slowly. Insight as different from ordinary external observation. It will also help your external, ordinary external observation. You will see more truly, you will listen more intently, you will touch more sensitively, and so on and so on. You see? So that the person grows from within all the time. And he will also learn to look within all the time, rather than to seek help from outside. Because one of the things that each person has to achieve is true egohood. That is the stage which has to be realized by the time one is a mature adult. And if we look at the 4,000 millions of people today in the world, how many of them realize true egohood? They are the abject slaves of the wrong sort of egohood. Egohood which is pure egoism, utterly self-centered, self-concerned, and they are conscious of themselves and the world in terms of isolativeness and separativeness. And therefore conflicts never cease. They go on and on and on, you see. Now this true egohood implies the harmony, the real harmony of our physical and psychological side, the psyche. Now the psyche has functions almost entirely in terms of duality for a very, very long period. In most people's lives, right till the end of their lives, they are born, they live more like animals. Bad animals. They live like beasts and die and make themselves a liability upon the whole world and a nuisance to everybody. This is a fact, isn't it? It's not uncompassionate to say these things because they are facts and we have to face them. And we have to face them with that compassion which recognizes that person is not the other person separate from me. I am that person is me. He and I are different versions of each other. Now, if this consciousness grows, it has to be not merely a thought. What I've said is just so many words. It can be just a simple thought which is expressed in a string of impotent words. But they make a meaningful pattern insofar as the brain can sort of say, yes, this is how it is at the moment. But that's not enough, you see. That has got to change, and one begins to see the directions in which the right change can take place and this harmony brought about. Also, there is the harmony of the masculine and feminine elements in our being. Every single male has feminine forces inside his psyche. Every single female has masculine forces inside her psyche. Now, these two forces have to balance. They not only have to balance, they have to work together, not as two different energies, but as a conjugating dual. A conjugating dual. The masculine fecundates the feminine element in one, in the male, and the feminine is fecundated by the masculine in her psychological nature, and so forth. And then there is something which is a really living, integrating energy liberated, which establishes the harmony of the whole being. Then there is true egohood. Now what has happened? Each separate person, as we ordinarily call him, each separate person has realized himself as an indivisible whole, the small whole. He is the indivisible whole, which is the microcosm. The next stage, if he lives long enough to arrive at that, and if he is fortunate enough in a sense, because circumstance has to help you a little bit, you see, if he is able to proceed further and develop, then he ends up with the realization in consciousness, he's conscious in that way. He realizes that individuality which is the totality. He, not just he alone is the indivisible whole, but he and what was previously called the whole of the not-self, the total universe, constitute one whole of which he is only one integral part and parcel. An integral part and parcel which is not in opposition to or not demanding from the whole at all, but is prepared to cooperate with that whole on perfectly equal terms. Equal is not quite the right word I want, but I trust you understand what I mean. Realizing, well, say if you take the human race, I have to realize I am only 1/4,000,000,000th part of that whole, you see, and my importance is just 1/4,000,000,000th. Actually, it is a little bit less, as I know to my cost, but there we are. You see, and that individuality, that indivisibility is the state of saintship. The whole, the Holy One. That is the state of saintship. It begins there. Saintship begins there. So, we may put it this way, that saintship marks your matriculation in the school of life with distinctions in all subjects. That's what saintship marks. You are now eligible for, and you are entitled, no one can refuse you, you are entitled to enter the university of life. Now, and therefore, it will be for you the university of the spiritual life. That will take first place in your activities, your efforts, your outlook and everything. You see, it's the spiritual life which has to go on and come to fruition. Now here, you will find that so many faculties which lie dormant in human beings, usually throughout their entire life, can find expression and come and develop. First and foremost, and this is the really important one, one's power of insight into the truth of things, into the nature of reality, begins to develop. And this is of fundamental importance, because once that transcendent sense begins to thrill inside you, you will find that all your old criteria, your judgments, your evaluations, what you thought was worthwhile or not worthwhile, and all of it will begin to fade away. It will not be destroyed, but it will begin to fade away in its old form. With pure insight, if there is pure insight, then you will awaken in consciousness to the functioning of your whole being in terms of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Now, if you consider infinity and eternity carefully, you will see that they totally negate the whole of the finite and the temporal sphere without destroying the finite and the temporal. Because if they destroyed the finite and temporal, it would imply, it would necessarily mean that the organism will perish, it will die. But they negate the values, the modes of understanding of the temporal and the finite. They will negate all that, but they will not destroy your power to see and know the finite and temporal in its true colors, its true worth, its true significance, its implications, its meanings, and so forth. You see? So this thing which comes to fruition in the university stage of the spiritual life is that your dormant faculties begin to flower out. And there are many, many and many. We needn't go into all that. Someday we might try and see something about it. But at present, let's go on. And the culmination of this is remarkably well expressed in the term the Samma Sambodhi, the perfect self-enlightenment. Note carefully, it's a self-enlightenment. Why? I mentioned help from outside in the early stages. But by the time you have arrived at saintship, help from outside has diminished almost to vanishing point. And then you wake up and actually live by the fact of your own true vision and understanding that your own organism is your best teacher. There is no other teacher which is so excellent as your own living organism. When you understand your own living organism thoroughly, you are capable of understanding all other people, all other sentient creatures. You know how it is said that the holy ones who live as recluses, as ascetics in the forests and so forth, they know the ways of the birds and the animals and the trees and everything. They know all that somehow in an extraordinary way. And they know it not by a mere brain knowing. They know it through that power in their own consciousness by which they can be conscious of that other thing. Their consciousness, so to say, lives through the animal or the tree or the bird or whatever it is. This is how they know, and that translates itself in our ordinary human terms by the brain. It is translated for us by the brain. So they are able to deal with it and to speak about it and so forth. So you see, all these faculties begin to emerge, and with the and because you have awakened to the fact that your own organism is your best teacher, the final fruition for us as human beings, and as far as we as members of the human species can possibly go, can take place. And therefore it is a self-enlightenment. The fully self-enlightened one. And the fully self-enlightened one is also the fully compassionate one. He is also the entirely truthful one. He is also entirely the capable one. He can make no mistakes. He suffers from no delusion whatsoever. And so forth. He is, as human beings, through many centuries, through the millennia in fact, have somehow or other sensed their perfection, and they have worshipped them as God incarnate. It's an extraordinary thing. The Buddha, even the Buddha, who sort of Orthodox Buddhism disclaims any sort of truck with God where the Buddha is concerned, but that sort of person is God incarnate. God is a much more convenient word than the fully self-enlightened phrase. The phrase which speaks of him as fully self-enlightened. Krishna, Zarathustra, Jesus, they all openly declared that they were the sons of God. Openly. That's why they crucified Jesus. When Caiaphas asked him, "Are you the son of the blessed?" They never would say Yahweh. They said, "Are you the son of the blessed?" And Jesus simply answered, "I am." Thereupon, all the rest followed. See, it's a tremendous thing to say. And there are, unfortunately, some people today in the world who claim that with no rights for such claims, and they give themselves all sorts of high-sounding names. They will call themselves the singers of eternal life, the great singers of eternal life. They will call themselves by the name which is applied only to the third person of the Hindu Trinity, Mahesh, Maheshwar, you see. They will have, they do not hesitate to have their writings printed by His divine grace or this, that or the other. They do not make no attempt to dissuade their followers from speaking of them as incarnate God and so forth. It's not necessary to do that. God is God, and godliness will inevitably flourish through Him and affect the total environment without His having to say anything. Look at the sun. The sun doesn't say, "I am the sun, I give you heat, I give you life, I am your Lord God." You see, what a wonder, fall down and worship me. Not at all. The sun just shines. Every second, 200, or every minute, 250 million tons of the sun's mass goes off in hydrogen explosions and gives out light and heat. Isn't it every minute or every something like that? It's incredible, the activity that goes on. And what sort of an activity? If you or I were present there, what would happen to us? Therefore, it's the grace, the mercy of God that we are kept at a safe distance from the sun. So, nevertheless, the sun shines. Similarly, with the perfectly self-enlightened one, he will shine as such, and you can't mistake it. And if you are sufficiently sensitive, if there is a sufficient humanity within oneself, you will take note of it, you will observe it, you will not observe it as somebody external, but as one who is in complete and total interrelationship with him or her, as the case may be, and your life will change accordingly. Instead of trying to draw the whole world unto oneself, you will give yourself unto the whole world. You will not be destroyed, but you will give your total self away. It's an extraordinary thing, and it's something very, very blissful if in the quiet moments you experience it something. This total giving of yourself, as if every cell of your body itself just went off into the totality. Not destroyed, but immortalized. It's an extraordinary thing, but there it is. So now, with the perfect self-enlightenment, you are the exemplar, the living exemplar of the truly human life. Time and again we've talked about the meaning of the word human. I must have said it, what, about 10,000 times by now. It means the happy, the blissful creator. That's what human means. And isn't that how all the religions conventionally describe God? God is in heaven in bliss. God is in the blissful state. Shiva's heaven is Vishnu's heaven, is it? Which is in Vaikuntha. That's Vishnu's heaven, isn't it? Vishnu's heaven is in Vaikuntha, is in utter bliss and so forth. And he is the sustainer of the whole universe and all that sort of thing, you see. So, that is the supreme perfection of the human. But remember, you don't remain as a separate human then. You are conscious equally, you can be equally at home in consciousness in the context of the infinite and the eternal and the immortal, therefore, as well as in the ordinary context of the finite and the temporal. Then, in that state, you can do no wrong. You know the old idea, the divine, associated with the divine right of kings, the king can do no wrong. That was the king. Therefore, the king was necessarily the perfected Holy One. Look at the life story of the Buddha when it was predicted that he will either be a world monarch or he will be the perfected Holy One, the liberator of mankind. You see? But at the time of his death, when they asked him, how shall we deal with the body and the corpse and so forth? The cremation was to take place as if for a king. It's very interesting, you know. It's so many of these little points which are missed out in the general studies and conversations and lectures and books and so on. These little points mean a great deal, a very great deal. So you have to take that into account. And then, if it is in your destiny, you may become a teacher. Not because you have sent in your application to the divine education department, you see, to teach humanity. But you just naturally teach. Your very existence is a teaching. Just like the very existence of the sun is the source of life and heat and light to us. It's like that. You will be a shower of the way. You will show the way without deliberately forming societies, groups and so forth. People will come to you. Look, when we have lovely sunny weather, what do? We just naturally move out to it, don't we? So that you become a teacher in that sense. You don't say, I want to be a teacher and show people this, that and the other. That is mere conceit. So, you will be a good teacher for all your younger brethren who are ready for and are longing to tread the holy way, the Brahmacharya. Live the holy life. And that is the only life which can legitimately be called the human life.